This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the Museum of the City of New York and their exhibitions on social activism and one called City of Workers, City of Struggle.
Two terrific exhibits. If you're living in New York, get up there. If you're not living in New York, come visit. And if you can't do either one, go to the Museum of the City of New York's website and you'll get a virtual history of it.
We're joined by Phyllis Bennett to discuss historical and recent U.S. antagonism toward Iran.
Last I read, Trump wanted to send 120,000 troops to the region. Things are plenty scary. Phyllis has a good analysis.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The Museum of the City of New York has two terrific exhibits, one permanent on social change activism at the Puffin Foundation Gallery, and the other, just up on May 1st, called City Workers, City of Struggle, also sponsored by the Puffin Foundation. The great American social historian Howard Zinn wrote that significant social change comes from below. These two exhibits demonstrate this. If you live in New York or plan to visit the city, you might like to check them out. And for you faraway listeners, you'll get a good virtual visit by going to the museum's website at mcny.org. The permanent exhibit on social change activism is most relevant in today's dire times of climate change and threatened nuclear catastrophe. The exhibits show by way of photos, documents, and videos how 14 past struggles were conducted and the gains that were won. They include exhibits from the movement to abolish slavery and the civil rights movement up to Black Lives Matter. Other exhibits bring to life anti-nuclear organizing, climate change activism, and the success of the mass mobilizations that won over public opinion and ended the war in Vietnam. Although the activism exhibit is permanent, it is not unchanging. Right now, a new section has been put up covering the struggle of trans people. A second gallery exhibit, which opened May 1st, examines how the labor movement transformed New York. Called City of Workers, City of Struggle, the exhibit shows how New York City, after two centuries of struggle, became the most unionized large city in the United States. Joining us in our New York studio is the curator of the organized labor exhibit, Dr. Stephen Jaffe. Steve also took a role in organizing the social activism exhibit. Steve Jaffe, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Great to be here.
Steve, what was your thinking when you set up the social activism exhibit?
Yeah, well, really the New York, the exhibit, Activist New York, that we've had up for several years now, came out of a meeting of the minds between the museum staff and the Puffin Foundation, which over the years has funded some really interesting, exciting projects at the museum. And I think there was an agreement that the museum really needed an entire dedicated gallery, which would tell the story of social and political activism over the last couple of centuries here in New York, with the notion that to truly understand the history and identity and the future of New York City, you have to understand its role as one of history's great activist centers. And conversely, if you want to really understand anything about the history of social activism in the modern world, you have to know something about New York. So in both those ways, we thought that this would be a great thing to do for the public, and we have not been disappointed. It's been a very successful gallery for the last several years for us.
And what were you trying to do in terms of showing things like the diversity of groups in the city?
Yes, well, we were really one of the key purposes of the exhibition was to show not only the great chronological duration, how we really can go back to the colonial era to start talking about New York as a sort of a hotbed or center of activism, but that as one of this world's great diverse places where wave upon wave of immigrant group and, of course, as well as African American and Puerto Rican and other people from within the United States, but of course also people from around the world, that each group comes and brings a set of expectations. In New York, partly through the exchange, collision, coming together in this very dense place of different activist groups, it has become a kind of incubator again and again for activism. And so the exhibition more concretely focuses on, if you look at the 14 different, if you will, chapters in the gallery, which take specific historical events or movements going all the way back to Dutch New Amsterdam in the 1650s and all the way up to Black Lives Matter today, that you get an exposure to the way in which activists have shaped civil rights movements in the city, movements for religious tolerance, the use of public space, labor rights, gender and sexual freedoms, and the list goes on. But New York has been that important to all of those things, environmentalism, so that part of the actual content of the gallery is to establish the sheer multiplicity and variety of ways in which New Yorkers have really shaped their own destinies and tried to help shape the destinies of people around the world and the country.
Speaking of environment and open spaces, I know one group you had featured, I'm not sure if it's still there, is Time's Up. They advocate for bicycling in the city.
Bill DiPaolo has been a good friend to us in various projects we've been doing. And of course, he has his own great museum, the Museum of Reclaimed Urban Space on the Lower East Side,
right,
or East Village, which all of your listeners should also be well aware of and go visit.
Right, they cover squatting and community gardens, among other things.
Absolutely, yeah, it's a really interesting place.
Steve Jaffe, you're the curator of the new show on labor, mm-hmm, but I wanted to ask you something more general. How do you measure success at the museum? Who comes to the various galleries? How many people come here? Where do they come from?
Yes. Well, statistically, we get somewhere in the neighborhood these days of about 320,000 visitors a year. And I should say, even though we're talking about activist New York and a city of workers, city of struggle, I should mention that we have another permanent exhibition, which pertains to activism and labor, which is New York at its core, which is three galleries on the first floor of the museum, which really tries to give you an overview of the entire history of the city. And that has proved enormously successful for us in concert with the two exhibitions we're talking about today. But anyway, to answer your question, we get over 300,000 people a year. The breakdown, my understanding is statistically, about 40% of those folks are New York City residents. Somewhere in the vicinity of about another third of them are from other parts of the United States, and the remainder, somewhere like 25-27%, something like that, is international. We get a lot of tourists who are interested in learning something about the history of the city. I should say, though, for the Activist New York exhibition in particular, our educational staff in the FAO Schwartz Center at the museum, Frederick A.O. Schwartz Center, has done an enormous job of creating programs for teachers and school groups and curriculum packages and professional development trainings for teachers, all with the active support of the Puffin Foundation, so that, for example, over the last year, we've had something in the neighborhood of 9,000 school children in school groups, with, of course, hundreds of teachers being brought to learn something at a really, we're talking K through 12. So even the younger grades are being given an age-appropriate sense of agency, if you will, in changing things that are wrong or bad. I think we all feel enormously happy about this, and it's been ongoing and shows no signs of letting up. It's actually, the Activist New York tours are the most, I'm told, are the most popular school field trip that the museum does. that teachers love it, kids respond. So it's been an enormous success. I should mention that both of these exhibitions, we have multifaceted outreach. So we actually have published two books, one Activist New York, and one now City of Workers, City of Struggle, edited by Joshua Freeman, professor at the CUNY Graduate Center and the Murphy Institute at CUNY. So we have the print piece that you can buy and take away. We obviously have web content. We have the galleries themselves. We have these teacher trainings and school groups. And sort of throughout the year, we have various public programs that the general public can come to. For example, I think on June 6th, we have a program coming up with two films relating to transgender history and transgender activism in New York in the 60s and 70s. And that's open to the public. So go to our web, go to www.mcny.org for any and all of this stuff that I've been talking about.
And if you want to get it in 3D, go up to the museum.
Yeah, right.
It's on the northern end of the museum mile on Fifth Avenue.
Yes.
It's between 102nd and 103rd Street.
103rd and 104th. I'll just in case they go to the Academy of Medicine instead.
I don't want to misdirect you. A beautiful building.
Yes.
And the whole thing is just a spectacular experience. I was up there last week, and it's what inspired us to ask you, Steve Jaffe, to come on the show.
Yeah, well,
let's talk about the various exhibits.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about some of the highlights, please.
Okay. Everyone has their own favorite objects and artifacts and so on. But, you know, actually, one of the things about the Activist New York Gallery to me is, again, the sheer diversity. So you can encounter something as provocative as an anti-Catholic propaganda book from the 1850s at a time when nativism meant anti-immigrant politics, really meant anti-Catholicism as much as anything else in New York City and the country at large. And there were political parties. I mean, this is sort of a foreshadowing of what we have now with a sort of hysteria about immigration. At least at that point, it wasn't veiled in kind of deracialized language by the politicians. They were very upfront about not wanting papists here because the Pope, if he got enough of his minions in America, they would take over and destroy Republican institutions and so forth and so on. And part of what we deal with there, of course, is with the response, which was movements by Roman Catholics in New York to protect themselves against this kind of bigotry. So we have something that old and that odd in a way. And then you cross the room and you have a placard in the shape of a black hand, which reads, "I can't breathe." And that's in our section on Black Lives Matter. And it was a placard developed by activists at Hostos Community College in 2014 after the Eric Garner death, which, of course, again, is in the news as we speak. And they used that placard. Of course, those were among his last words, "I can't breathe," as he was being basically throttled to death. And so that was a piece of agitprop, if you will, that people carried en masse in various rallies having to do with the rise of the Black Lives Matter Black Lives Matter movement in New York City.
Do you get calls from the public with ideas for shows?
We do sometimes, but we've found that, as with everything else in this world that we live in, it comes down to who has the money to support good ideas. And what we've done, for example, with the Puffin Foundation is really evolve a relationship where they have brought good ideas and then we develop them. I mean, they've been, I guess really it's been more than a decade, they've done some really interesting projects with us. We did a show, I should say, with their help called Radicals in the Bronx, which was about cooperative housing in the 1920s and 30s, you know, the communists, the socialists, the Zionists, everyone. There was a moment of semi-public housing and cooperative.
Co-op city.
But this is really looked at the pre-co-op city phase in the 20s and 30s, where it was so infused with the fervor of people who are either in the Socialist Party or the Communist Party or labor Zionists or what have you. And then they funded an exhibition called Facing Fascism, which was about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and New Yorkers who went to Spain to fight against Franco and Hitler and Mussolini in the 30s, and also about the scene in New York at the time with political agitation to try to get us to intervene, which, of course, FDR would not permit. So what I'm saying is that people do come with ideas. The real sad part is 1,000 great ideas, limited time, limited space. So we do the best with sort of this hitting the sweet spot between the great ideas, what's fundable, and what actually is exhibitable in terms of artifacts.
Steve, you were the main curator of the exhibit on City of Workers, City of Struggle.
Right.
How labor movements changed New York. You write that, quote, for more than two centuries, New York City has been an incubator and battleground of movements by and for working people, and today 24% of New York City workers are unionized, compared to the national average of only 11%. Mm-hmm. How do you explain that?
Well, I think it actually reflects some of the things we've already been talking about in terms of New York being a city transformed by immigration over the centuries, but also the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century and 20th century, where you have a place that's becoming easily by 1850, 1860 even, simultaneously one of the richest and poorest places on earth.
Like now.
And you therefore have this kind of sense of, it's really hard to avoid the presence of a class society that's emerging. And plus, it is the place, as the great immigrant entry port, it is the place which is in most direct contact with Europe, more so arguably than anywhere else on the East Coast. And so to the extent that Europe in the 19th century, as we know, is generating socialism, communism, various nationalisms, feminism, that all of these different movements can cross the Atlantic with people, but also with information, newspapers, and so forth, to New York. And New York becomes the great hub of a kind of sensibility or consciousness of an emerging working class world. And of the notion that collective effort, that solidarity, will be the way in which working people can perhaps defend themselves and also fight back for better material and political conditions.
Steve, to the best of your knowledge, are there any other museums like the Museum of the City of New York in other states across the nation?
Well, in New Jersey, of course, there's I believe it's the American Labor Museum, or Botto House, B-O-T-T-O House, in Haledon, New Jersey, which was the site of much of the planning and public agitation around the great 1913 Paterson, New Jersey silk strike. So you had Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and Carlo Tresca and Hubert Harrison and Big Bill Haywood, all these wobblies, industrial workers of the world, leaders, and of course, thousands of immigrant silk workers, let alone, never mind the Greenwich Village Bohemians who came over to do the big pageant, or actually did it in Madison Square Garden, but came over to see what was going on in 1913, John Reed and the rest of them. So that's a great place to explore. And I would have to think a little bit about your question. There have been some interesting exhibitions. There's even been the Victoria and Albert Museum, I believe, in London had a great show a few years ago, maybe more like 3 or 4 years ago, on activist art. So there are, but I mean, I think your question is also to the point of the fact that there aren't enough of these around. And I mean, I'm thinking Lowell, the National Historic Site in Lowell, Massachusetts, deals with industrialization and some of the early labor movement among the so-called mill girls in the 19th century.
But you're really about the heart and the history of New York City.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this isn't an exhibition, although I would hasten to add that one of our points here is New York has been a seedbed for the country and even internationally for labor agitation and progressive successes. That idea of, from the people who brought you The Weeknd, the notion that some of the things we take for granted, although maybe less so now. I mean, there was a time we took for granted the 40-hour week, work week, and what that meant. And of course, people now work longer hours. And of course, also you have the problem of a gig economy that's rapidly changing and where people don't get to work 40 hours, even if they want to. One of the most fascinating things I should say about so far with the City of Workers, City of Struggle exhibition is that we do have a sign-in book and also a web address where people can respond to the exhibition. And one comment, and you learn from people who feel that they've either been left out or minimized or, well what about such and such? And we did have one comment from someone saying, you're really not dealing enough with the fact that so much of our labor, or my labor, I think the person said now, is part-time. And I can't make ends meet. I can't fill the time that I need to fill, and I'm running around. And so many of the, and this is precisely what we want to do. We want to elicit the comments of people for whom this isn't ancient history at all. It's unfolding right now. And I think one of the great successes of the exhibition also is that we've taken it up to what's happening in New York and the nation right now. We have a wonderful film created as part of the exhibition by my colleagues, Rebecca Jacobs and Nate Levy, where they went to City Hall the day of the big rallies in late January over the Amazon plan to build a second headquarters in Queens. And the fascinating thing was you had unions on both sides of that, because the building trades unions and 32BJ, which is maintenance workers, traditionally a progressive union, were on the side of building it because they wanted the jobs. The Teamsters, RWDSU, which is the retail, wholesale, and department store workers, were vehemently opposed because they saw Amazon as a union-busting operation. I should say they were willing to converse with Amazon if Amazon was willing to unionize or make some kind of concession, but they were not. And, of course, on Valentine's Day, Amazon pulled the plug on the idea. However, people don't realize that on Staten Island there's an Amazon fulfillment center. In other words, an Amazon warehouse for shipping books and so on and other goods around. And there is now an effort on the part by some of the workers there to working with not only unions such as RWDSU, but worker centers like Make the Road New York, to unionize at the risk of their jobs, because one of the people who became conspicuous was summarily fired. So this is all going on, let alone, all you have to do is pick up the newspaper now, and you have, of course, the issue, this emerging, erupting scandal having to do with the taxi medallions and the way people have been exploited shamelessly, both by lenders and also some officials. And in fact, one of the things we do in the exhibition is talk about the worker centers, talk about and show material relating to the Taxi Drivers Alliance. We have someone on film talking about the Taxi Drivers Alliance and various other non-union organizations like the Domestic Workers Alliance and Make the Road New York and others. So we feel very proud and very excited that for all the challenges labor is fighting in New York today, people continue to fight and continue to struggle and continue to innovate. And New York remains an incubator of that.
I think it was a year or so ago you also showed a film on the Young Lords.
Right. And actually, there's a clip from the documentary footage currently in the Activist New York Gallery. We have a section that my colleague Sarah Seidman, who's the current curator of Activist New York and is doing a spectacular job with it, on the Young Lords, the history of the Young Lords, dating back to the late 60s and 70s. This great group of, frankly, very idealistic young, mostly college educated Puerto Rican radicals in New York who wanted to, among other things, improve conditions in El Barrio, in Lousada on the Lower East Side, and other neighborhoods. And actually, there's footage of the takeover of what they called the People's Church
right. In
East Harlem.
And they worked a lot to improve the health conditions in hospitals.
Absolutely. Hospitals, innovative heroin treatment plan in the Bronx at Lincoln Hospital. They basically more or less hijacked an x-ray truck and brought it to East Harlem to take free x-rays of people in a neighborhood where the tuberculosis rate was really a function of poverty. And the city ultimately kind of went along with them on that. They did lead poisoning testing in terms of lead paint that was peeling off tenement walls when landlords neglected to follow the law in terms of painting with safe paint.
So, issues, yes, we're still dealing with.
Absolutely, but people continue to fight, and that's what has to happen. Struggle is the meaning of it all. One thing I've said in context of these exhibitions is, someone once asked Karl Marx what the meaning of life was, and he responded with one word: struggle. And I have said to museum audiences, you don't have to be a Marxist to believe that. For that matter, you don't have to be a Marxist at all, but it's an interesting word to think about, certainly New York City. And not only its opportunities for people, which often involve struggle, but also its challenges and the spark for militancy, which comes from some recognition that, hey, wait a minute, things can be better, and I need to work with others to try to affect that. And that is as much a thread which runs through, I think, both of these exhibitions that we're talking about, the Labor Exhibition and Activist New York.
Well, Steve Jaffe, we're coming to an end of our allotted time, but I have a couple of more questions, and I think Heidi has one also,
okay,
that I wanted to ask you. And if you don't mind, on a personal note, how does someone like you went to undergraduate school at Princeton, you got your PhD at Harvard, how did you come to the job you now have, yeah, at the Museum of the City of New York?
Yeah, well, I couldn't really have predicted that path, by and large, although in retrospect, it's understandable. I came back to New York City in 1993 after leaving Massachusetts because my wife and I wanted to live in the city, and the academic job market was very restrictive. You had to be very, very lucky to land geographically where you wanted to. And so I resorted to teaching high school for a short time. And then by sheer karma or something, I kind of fell into a job doing historical research at the South Street Seaport Museum downtown, a wonderful institution, and stayed there for 9 years, then moved on for a little while to the New York Historical Society. This is all it sort of segued into curating historical exhibitions. Now I work at the Museum of the City of New York, another terrific place. You know, looking back on it, I did have the PhD in history and was always fascinated from the time I was a little boy in Greenwich Village with the city's history. But I also had a very vivid visual sense. And when I think about history, I see it. It's a visual experience. And I went to the High School of Music and Art here in the city. And so ultimately, being a museum curator, where you have to think about presenting to the public history in a vivid, sensory way, whether that's something you're looking at or something you're listening to, or in some instances something you can touch, is really essential. And so the visual and the historical came together very nicely. I feel very lucky that that happened for me.
Steve, how can people find out more about the Museum of the City of New York and the Social Activism Gallery and the City of Workers Gallery?
Yeah, well, I think the easiest way, apart from just coming up to 1220 Fifth Avenue in Manhattan between 103rd and 104th Streets and actually walking in the door, of course, the easiest way is to go to our website, which is mcny.org, and there you will get a sort of smorgasbord of information and images having to do with our various exhibitions, because actually we have, at any given point, we have several other public exhibitions people can explore as well, but also our public programs, lectures, film series. We're going to be doing a sort of al fresco, weather permitting, viewings of On the Waterfront and Modern Times and some other labor-related films this summer at the museum. We have other panels, symposia, workshops, lectures, and of course you can get information about our wonderful educational programs for both students and adults. So there's a whole world of information on our website about the museum and its activities.
Well, Steve, great having you on Law and Disorder. A shout out to the Puffin Foundation for making this happen.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
In late 2017 and early 2018, Iran was shaken by a wave of protests. Economic hardships from austerity measures spawned demonstrations that spread to more than 80 cities and towns in a public showing of discontent not seen since the 2009 presidential elections there. American policy is now aimed at exacerbating hardships there. After the signing of a historic nuclear agreement in 2015, American and Iranian diplomats grew acquainted with each other in a departure from the past when they weren't even allowed to talk. Many were hopeful that more talks on other topics might take place, including conflicts in Afghanistan, Iran, Syria, and Yemen. But when Donald Trump became president, he pulled out of the nuclear deal and blamed Iran for the Middle East's problems. He added Iran to the list of countries whose citizens would be banned from entering the United States. And he designated the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization. Trump also put severe economic sanctions on the country, causing terrible hardships to Iranian citizens. He sent bombers and an aircraft carrier to the region, and just last week, he threatened to obliterate the country. Joining us today to talk about U.S.-Iran relations is Phyllis Bennis. Phyllis is a writer, activist, and political commentator, focusing primarily on issues related to the Middle East and the United Nations. She is a critic of Israel and the U.S. and a leading advocate of Palestinian rights. Phyllis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Phyllis, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Great to be with you.
Now, a few years ago, Senator John McCain famously sang "Bomb, Bomb, Bomb Iran" to the tune of a Beach Boys song. When did the American demonization of Iran begin, and why?
I think to really understand his little bomb, 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 Iran kind of ditty, as he liked to put it, you have to go back to 1979. That was when the United States saw Iran as having betrayed the long-standing alliance that the U.S. had had with Iran ever since 1953, even further back, when the U.S. led a coup to overthrow the democratically elected president of Iran, Mohammad Mossadegh, who was threatening to, oh my God, nationalize Iran's oil, and replaced him with the repressive, brutal, but our guy, U.S.-backing Shah of Iran. The Shah, and then Shah Jr., his son, ran the country until 1979, when a revolutionary movement, which had left components, secular components, and religious extremist components, carried out a revolutionary process against overthrowing the Shah and installing instead a very intensely religious government led by the Ayatollah Khomeini. At that time, that was when we first saw the kind of deployment of Islamophobia as a huge weapon in the U.S. arsenal of war. I remember from back in those days, I think most of us are old enough to remember that, there were T-shirts that had pictures of the Ayatollah with a target printed over his face. It was that blatant. And that was a sense that not just this country had put in office a government we didn't like, but there was this real sense of betrayal. How could they do this? This was our country. This was a country that was supposed to have a government we liked. And so there was a much more intense antagonism that flipped into this major kind of Islamophobic campaign. During that revolutionary process, of course, people will remember either because they remember it or they've read it in the history books, some of the young student supporters of the revolution occupied the U.S. embassy in Tehran, holding a bunch of U.S. diplomats, I think it was 50 or 55 diplomats, hostage for several months. And that episode became kind of the image of what the Iranian Revolution was all about. Put aside that it was really all about reclaiming the country for the people rather than this very isolated, brutal regime backed by the United States. Put aside all of that, and what it was supposed to be, what we were told here in the United States, is that this is all about anti-Americanism, and the only thing important in this whole process is that 50 or 55 of our diplomats are being held hostage. Now, there's no question that the hostage-taking was, in fact, a violation of international law. It was a violation of the Vienna Convention on the Protection of Embassies. That's all certainly true. It's also true that it was part of a much bigger process that was underway in transforming this country. But ever since that time, the antagonism between sequential U.S. governments, Democrats, Republicans, everybody, towards Iran has been absolutely palpable. So you get to these claims of Iran is the biggest proponent of international terrorism in the world. I say, really? What are you talking about? And there's a few episodes back in the 1980s when terrorist actions were carried out by groups that were thought to be supported by Iran. That's pretty much what you're talking about. And in that time period, the antagonism towards Iran has remained really central. And it's particularly strong among the neoconservatives who, among other things, went into led the campaign to go into Iraq militarily to overthrow Saddam Hussein after 9/11. And there was a famous statement from one of the neocons, and I'm blocking which one it was, who said, everybody wants to invade Baghdad. Real men want to go to Tehran. And there was this sense that from the beginning, from decades ago, Iran has been the real enemy of the United States in a very profoundly ideological way. And it remains that today.
Phyllis, that was an excellent overview that brings us to current day. What has Donald Trump's foreign policy done to Iran?
Well, you know, history is always shaped by when you start the clock, and the U.S. relations with Iran is no different. The most recent things, if we want to look at just the last year, the most important thing was the decision to withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal, a deal that had been signed by six countries, Iran and five other countries, back in 2015, supported strongly by the Obama administration, opposed strongly by many in Congress, including both Democrats and Republicans, particularly strongly opposed by the strongest supporters of Israel, the Israeli government being one of the main opponents of the Iran nuclear deal. And Trump ran on a platform that said, I will pull us out of this deal. It's a terrible deal. Now, the deal that he wanted so badly to pull out of and then did just a year ago was a deal that the International Atomic Energy Agency, the UN watchdog groups, and all of the intelligence agencies from all the countries that signed on to this deal, and that was the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, China, and Russia, all of those intelligence agencies agreed Iran was abiding by the terms of the deal. even Trump didn't really claim that they were not. His claim was the deal isn't good enough. So the deal prevented Iran from moving forward if it ever decided to, and the U.S. had been very clear that they had not decided to, that if they ever decided to, they would not be able to make a nuclear weapon because the enriched uranium that they had been producing for nuclear power, was being shipped out of the country. It was already not good enough to be used in a weapon, but it was the same technology. This deal made Iran stop producing any kind of enriched uranium and shipped out of the country 97% of the stockpiles they actually had at that time. So it essentially stripped Iran of any possible pathway towards getting a nuclear weapon sometime in the future, if they ever decided to. So it was a very effective treaty. The most important thing, the most damaging thing that Trump has done was to withdraw from that treaty, claiming that, well, it didn't deal with Iran's role in the region. It didn't deal with their supposedly nefarious foreign policy. It didn't deal with X, Y, and Z other things, which was, of course, the whole point of the Iran nuclear deal, was that it focused on nuclear weapons, and that was what made it possible to succeed. If it had included all this other stuff, it never would have been agreed to by such a diverse group of global powers. So that's the single most important thing that Trump has done. More recently, when the threat level has been ratcheted up, he's doing things like increasing the sanctions, not just replacing the sanctions that had been lifted in return for Iran's agreement not to pursue any of the technology that in the future could maybe sometime possibly move towards a nuclear weapon, but the U.S. had agreed to lift the nuclear-related sanctions. Suddenly, all those sanctions are reimposed. And just in the last couple of months, new sanctions have been imposed. And sanctions are being imposed on other countries who might have the temerity to think that they have the sovereign right to trade with whoever they want to, including Iran. And the U.S. is threatening the Europeans, it's threatening China, it's threatening Turkey, it's threatening everybody who might dare buy Iranian oil. So the sanctions are being ratcheted up, and the population in Iran is suffering a great deal. The most recent things included sending a U.S. aircraft carrier group, which is a hugely intimidating flotilla of dozens of ships anchored by a giant aircraft carrier, and a fleet of nuclear-capable B-52 bombers to the area right close to Iran. So it's ratcheted up the threat even higher. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo did a sudden secret trip to Iraq, Iran's neighbor, to try and persuade the government there, which of course was installed by the United States, is backed by the United States, but is very loyal to Iran in many ways as well, tried to persuade them to stop buying electricity from Iran, where they have actually no obvious replacement for that electricity, but threatening all kinds of sanctions if they didn't stop that. So the pressure is rising. And the threat, of course, is that in a place like the Strait of Hormuz, the part of the waters outside of Iran, where something like 40% of the world's oil passes on a daily basis, the threat of a mistake, some young sailor on either side gets frightened when they see a flare, for instance, from a small boat and decides, oh my God, we're being attacked, and responds militarily, that could be all the U.S. needs to actually go to war. I don't think right now the Trump administration is united around initiating a war. Certainly National Security Advisor John Bolton has been cheerleading for a war in Iran for more than 20 years. And he still is. And he has the first and last word in the president's ear, which is a very dangerous reality. But there doesn't seem to be a unified position, certainly not by the president himself, on initiating a war with Iran. It doesn't mean it couldn't happen. But what's more dangerous is the possibility of this kind of an accidental war, which the U.S. could then decide to respond to in a way that immediately ratchets up to what would become an incredibly dangerous long-term war.
Well, it could lead to a nuclear war, could lead to a worldwide depression.
It would be just a catastrophe, and that's what's so scary. And Phyllis, do you think that Iran is really a credible threat to the United States? After all, they spend somewhere between $15 and $30 billion a year on their military compared to the American expense, which is at least $700 billion.
Right. They are not even in the top 10 of military spenders. Their military is nothing compared to that of the United States. So in the sense of, is Iran a serious threat to the United States? No. Now, is it a strong military power in the region? Absolutely. It's a big country. It's 80 million people, a big landmass. This would not be like the war in Iraq, which, if you remember, was supposed to be a cakewalk, turned out to be something far worse, something far greater in terms of the ability of people in Iraq to mobilize against this foreign attack and occupation. Iran would be far worse than that. It's bigger, it's stronger, it does have a strong military. What is important is that Iran does have a military capacity at the local and regional level to attack U.S. allies. One of the things that's going on under the Trump administration has been a huge emphasis in what they like to call diplomacy, which has been the mobilization of an anti-Iran front anchored by Israel and Saudi Arabia, the two key U.S. allies in the region. And the U.S. has been urging them to work more closely together, has been providing, as we know, billions of dollars worth of U.S. weapons to both Saudi Arabia and Israel getting them free, $3.8 billion a year in military support directly to the military, and Saudi Arabia, of course, buying hundreds of millions of dollars worth of weapons over the years aimed at Iran. So this whole notion of how does this move forward, what the U.S. calls diplomacy, is really escalating the warmongering and the danger of war against Iran.
Phyllis, I was actually going to ask, do weapons manufacturers and military contracts try to push a fear of Iran?
Yeah. I don't think that we see that directly, only because it's not necessary. The argument is being made, they certainly have a powerful lobby outfit, and we've heard discussion of that, of the power of that lobby, the military producers lobby. They are very powerful. Their CEOs make millions of dollars a year in bonuses and in salaries for these bloated corporations. We should note the U.S. military budget, which, as you just said, is over $700 billion. This year it's $716 billion. Next year it will be $750 billion. Half of that, just about half of that, goes directly to U.S. military manufacturers, to military contractors. So this is really welfare for these giant corporations and their multi-million dollar salaried CEOs. They don't have to do that much lobbying, although they do some, because it's been such a given in the congressional world of how these decisions get made that no one wants to vote against money to the military, and most members of Congress are not willing to vote against specific weapon systems, even the ones like the F-35 that the Pentagon says they don't even want. It doesn't work. It's a plane that has exploded on the runway for unexplained reasons. This is a plane, a bomber that nobody wants, and yet none of them will vote against it. Why? Because the components of that plane are produced in 350 congressional districts, which is, of course, completely not the most efficient way to build a plane, we should be clear, but it is the most efficient way to make sure that you never risk losing your funding, because no member of Congress, whatever they think about the F-35, whatever they think about the military-industrial complex, whatever they think about the U.S. wars, they're not going to be willing to vote against a military project that is providing jobs in their district. Whether it's 12 people in a little workshop somewhere producing some little gizmo that goes into some bigger gizmo, or whether it's, you know, the senator from Boeing in Washington who's looking at thousands of people who work on the planes, whatever it is, they're not going to be willing to vote against it. So it's an incredibly strategic way of making sure that the military producers, that the military corporations maintain their power and their stranglehold on the U.S. Congress and its funders.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that the executives in these military companies are often people that have come out of the armed forces, another aspect of the military-industrial complex.
And vice versa. We have now the acting Secretary of Defense, who's about to be coming before the Senate for ratification as to be the permanent Secretary of Defense, worked for Boeing for years. He, you know, so this revolving door in both directions is a huge component of how this all works.
Phyllis Bennis, before I ask you what you think we need to do to change the policy towards Iran, I wanted to ask you to describe Iran's current regime.
Iran's government is a very interesting phenomenon. It has both a position that's known as the supreme leader, who is a religious figure, who is, you know, the kind of both titular and, in fact, the most powerful person in the country. Within that, or beneath that, there is a very vibrant parliamentary democracy, in which both what are known as hardliners, who tend to be stronger in urging Iran to stick with its military capacity, less willing to enter into deals with the United States, etc., and a reformist wing, which has been on the ascendancy in recent years, but is in danger in some ways. The ones who supported the Iran nuclear deal, who urged people to support it on the basis that this was going to be the way of improving the economy because it would lead to the lifting of sanctions. Those people are now on the defensive, both their elected representatives in the Majlis, the parliament, and supporters in the street, who are now faced with a situation where the small gains that were beginning to be seen in the economy have been ended, and in fact the economy is worse than ever. There is also, of course, a significant, serious set of human rights challenges in Iran, and there are human rights defenders who have attempted, with some success on some smaller issues, not so much success on the bigger issues. So there are, you know, this is a country with a level of internal struggle around human rights issues, around economic issues, but it's a country with a very vibrant political level of engagement, I would say, even though there is this overarching power vested in the Ayatollah, who is the Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the supreme leader and does hold that supreme power.
Phyllis Bennis, here's the question of all questions. What will it take to change our attitude towards Iran?
Well, that's a hard question indeed. Mostly, and I think that on this level there's some good news, it's about education. It's about letting people know Iranians are just like us, not only because, as we hear all the time, how the Iranian people are so different from their regime because they are all pro-American. First of all, these days, I'm guessing they're not all pro-American so much. They know who's responsible for the sanctions that are making their lives a living hell. But Iranians are among the best educated people in the region. They have huge issues around inequality, issues of class, issues of who has access to the best education, all those problems that we have here. I would say they deal with them somewhat better than we do, but they're still serious problems. But we have to talk with people in this country about who are the Iranians. You know, there are huge Iranian expatriate communities in the United States. Parts of Los Angeles, particularly parts of Beverly Hills, because it's a very wealthy community, is known as Little Tehran. And that's been true for a long time. Iranian culture is all around us, but those of us who work in anti-war arenas, who have worked for a long time to try to change U.S. policy, and that always requires changing the public discourse, we have an obligation to do that kind of talking, that kind of education about what kind of a country Iran is. Is it a threat to the U.S., and why isn't it? You know, we hear a lot from supporters of Israel, that the real reason we should be going to war or threatening to go to war against Iran or at least imposing these crippling sanctions against Iran is because Iran is an existential threat to Israel. The reality is, no, it's not. Israel has the strongest military in the region. The only actual nuclear arsenal in the region doesn't belong to Iran, which doesn't have nuclear weapons. It belongs to Israel. Israel is the only country in the region that has a nuclear arsenal of hundreds of nuclear weapons. Even if at some point in the future, and hopefully this will never come to pass, but if the Iranian government or a future Iranian government decided that they were going to try to build a nuclear weapon or buy a nuclear weapon or whatever, even that would not be an existential threat to Israel or Israelis. It would be a threat to Israel's nuclear control of the region. Right now, Israel has a nuclear monopoly. An Iranian nuclear weapon, as terrible as it would be to have any more nuclear weapons, would be a threat to that monopoly. Not a threat to people because it couldn't be used any more than Israel could safely use its own nuclear weapons and not realize that it's going to come back in that very small and crowded region of the world, that it's going to, its effects are going to come back to its own population. So, you know, this notion that Iran is somehow inherently a threat to Israel simply isn't true.
Phyllis, how can listeners read your work and get in touch with the Institute?
Well, our website has all this stuff on it. Our website is ips-dc.org. I also have a book that's a bit dated now. It's basically about the Bush years, but it's about the Iran crisis. It's called Understanding the U.S.-Iran Crisis. It's a small book of FAQs, of frequently asked questions about Iran, that unfortunately, even though it's now been some years since the book came out, it's unfortunately still relevant in looking at the origins of U.S. anti-Iran hysteria, how the Iran crisis links to Islamophobia, the origins of the threats against Iran in the early 2000s during the Iraq War. And people can get that from interlinkbooks.com.
Phyllis, it's always so informative to have you on, and you make complex subjects easy to understand.
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Phyllis Bennis, terrific talking with you. You take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.